nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
So, I guess I thought as a good starting point would be this formula for current that you have probably seen a few times now already. And you know, we've been talking about how you think about current flow. Now, although I won't really be using this very much, but the point I wanted to make here is that number two there, okay? And what's that? It's two spins. And you see, usually what happens then, when you talk about current flow in semiconductor devices, that's how the spin enters, as a factor of two in the appropriate place, and the main thing is to make sure you don't count it more than once, do it right, etc. Whereas spintronics, of course, is essentially about trying to control spins, the two spins separately, so that it's not just a factor of two at the end. Because the basic idea here is that if you look at the density of states or the number of modes, usually they will all come in pairs. Every time there's an upspin one, there's a downspin that goes with it. And so in that sense, it's almost like two separate devices in parallel, the ups and the downs, which is why you can multiply by two and get away. It's like you have two devices in parallel, essentially. Okay? Now, that's why for this purpose, I think it's useful to draw the density of states separately for the upspins and the downspins. Whereas usually we just draw one. So here I'm going to draw two of them. You see? So we have this channel with two contacts, like we have always been talking about. And we have this density of states. This axis is energy. I'm just drawing the density of states. And I'm using the two sides here to represent the two spins, the ups and the downs. So not, usually you think of this as being the negative of that. That's not it. Everything here is positive. I'm just drawing it on this side so you can separate it out, see it clearly. That's all. Okay? Now there's two ways you could get spin-dependent properties. One is by having something special about the contacts, so that they inject or detect your spins differently. Or you could do something about the channel itself. Okay? And a lot of the progress in the last 10, 20 years, you know, and which is really amazing progress that has happened, which is what I'll try to describe in the first part of my talk a little bit. And it really involves not so much the channel itself as the contacts. In other words, these very interesting spin-dependent properties all come from using a special kind of contact. Namely, instead of the normal things, it's a magnet. So, let me just draw it here. So this is like the direction of the magnet. So it's a magnetic contact. So typically it would be something like iron or cobalt, magnetic thing, whereas what's in between, that's still non-magnetic. And here, the two spins have exactly the same density of states like always, like in silicon, like in gallium arsenide, in every other material it's that way. So this is exactly the same. But here, because these are magnets, there's a big difference between the upspin and the downspins. So if you looked here, it would be like the upspins here are like this, and the downspins are like this. So there is a big shift in the bands between the upspins and the downspins in the magnet. So up meaning those that are in the direction of the magnet, down meaning those are opposite. And let's say your chemical potential happens to be, say, somewhere here. And if you look here, again, same situation, I suppose. So basic channel, nothing new, just like silicon, is the contacts that are different. Okay? And the basic experimental fact, I think, which was first observed like over 20 years ago now, was that you'd get a different resistance depending on whether the two magnets were parallel or anti-parallel. So if you, the way I've drawn it, you'd call it parallel, the two magnets pointing in the same direction, or if they pointed in opposite directions, that's the anti-parallel, and the resistance was significantly different. I mean, that's what's known as the giant magnetoresistance effect, which was recognized with a Nobel Prize like a few years back, I think 2007, the GMR. And the basic way, the simplest model with which you can understand this would be something like this. You think of, you see, this interface has a certain resistance. So I could draw a picture like this. And then there's the channel with some resistance. And then there's the interface again. So there's these two interfaces. So I'll call this small. And this is just the channel. So that's the one spin. And then you have the other spin. Now, as far as the channel is concerned, that's non-magnetic. So whatever you get for one spin, the other one, much the same. And the best devices, this should be negligible compared to the rest. So in other words, all the important properties we are talking about is really from the interface resistance. Not much action in the middle. That's just connecting it. See? So it's all about the two ends. And you'll notice I've written a small r here and a big r here. The idea being that you see that resistance, this interface resistance, that depends on how easily an electron can get out into the contact. So if you think of one of these red electrons from here trying to get out, it has lots of states here to get out into. Why? Because this band is kind of down here, so there's lots of states there, lots of modes, gets out easily. See? On the other hand, when a black one is trying to get out, it's someone here, then you have only a few. And so the interface resistance that the black one sees is different from the interface resistance that the red one sees. And that's the small r and the capital R. And what would happen if we had the magnets anti-parallel, in the sense we actually turned that one around? Well, as far as this picture is concerned, the way it would change is something like this. So much the same, you still have this interface resistances, something in the channel. But you see now, when you look at the red electrons, they have a low resistance on this side because there's lots of space to get out. But here, of course, it is the reds now are minority. So it is like this one is the red. So this is now the red. And the other one is now the black. So what that means is, when the red one tries to get out on the other side, it has a tough time getting out, so it's a big resistance now. And here the roles are reversed. So just from this picture, actually, you can explain why the parallel and the anti-parallel have different resistances, and it explains what you observe fairly well, actually, from a choice of these two parameters, interface resistance. So you can see, of course, instinctively you can see that what you really want is that this should be a minor part of the story. Because that's the part that really doesn't discriminate between the two spins, if anything is kind of diluting things. This you want to have a minor part. And if the rest of it is what determines the resistance, then you see you can write the resistance of this structure something like this. There'll be resistance, so this is the parallel structure. You got 2r, 2 small r, and then 2 big r in parallel. So you could write it as, I guess I could, let me write the 1 divided by I think I did that right. So that's the conductance of this path. This is the conductance of that path. I've added the two. The two are in parallel. So that's the overall conductance. And then I put that. So that would be there. Whereas when you do this one, it'll look like RAP is equal to. So now you got R plus R in parallel with R plus R. So basically it will just be half. So those would be the two expressions. Now, with a little algebra, you can show that this will always be lower than that. So the parallel resistance will always be lower. Now, one extreme case you can see without doing any algebra, and that is, supposing we had really good contacts. I mean, this is what people would really like, what they call half metallic contacts, which means if this black thing were up here. So what that means is an electron with that energy can't even get out. No states at all. Then of course your capital R would have been infinite. So that's what you'd call the perfect half metallic contact. One type gets out, the other one doesn't. That'd be perfect. So you see, if R were infinite, then you see the anti-parallel resistance would be infinite. This is it. But the parallel resistance, of course, infinite means this goes out, but you still have this one. So, in other words, you still have this path, so you'd still be conducting. This is open. But here, both paths are gone. You don't get out either way. So that limit, you see without any algebra. But the point is, even with non-ideal things, this will always be smaller than that one. Okay? And what you can show is there's something they call this magnetoresistance. Usually. And the magnetoresistance, I believe, comes out as this P squared divided by 1 minus P squared, where P is defined as so it's just with this very simple model, with some algebra, you'd get to something like this. The P is what you call the polarization of the contact. Electrically defined, that it tells you how different one resistance is from the other. That's it. And this magnetoresistance then, I think the way they define it is would be the ratio of, I think, the difference divided by RAP. I think that's the standard definition, which will get you something like this. So it's like if P were 1, this would have been infinite. It would be very large if P were 1. That means if you actually got to a point where one of these was infinite, for example, then that's a perfect polarization. Only one type of spin gets out, the other one doesn't. Okay. That would be the ideal. Now, this field kind of started, as I said, with the discovery of this effect, which was then called this giant magnetoresistance effect, GMR. And it involved, basically just what I said, two magnets with another metal in between, I think copper, I think what was used. So this is a non-magnetic thing with two magnets there. Now, since then what has happened is the field has moved on. That is, when you first started, although it's called giant magnetoresistance, it wasn't really very big. I believe it is some number much less than 10%. That's what we're really talking about. Whereas, nowadays there's something they call TMR, tunneling magnetoresistance. So, the usual word was GMR. That's what started it. And then there's this TMR. That's called tunneling magnetoresistance. And what's happened there is, the basic structure is still the same, except that this, instead of being copper, is like a insulator, an oxide. Like these days I think they use magnesium oxide. That's the insulator that they use. And naturally and electrons are tunneling through that insulator. And to tunnel through, as you might expect, that's usually a very thin thing. Something like 2 or 3 nanometers at best. Some very thin insulator. So these are what are called the magnetic tunnel junctions, which are now widely used for reading information. So the way it works is that information is stored in magnets, as you know, in magnetic disks. And this might be a one, that might be a zero. So you have a structure like this where you have a reference magnet and you measure the resistance. And if the resistance happens to be high, it tells you you're in one state. If it's low, it tells you you're in the other state. So the resistance lets you measure it. And as I said, when it all started, we were talking of a very small change, but even then it was good enough to be useful. And now, as I said, these TMRs, that the tunneling magnetoresistances that people talk about, that's like way up. I mean, numbers I hear are like 200%, 300%. So it's a very big effect that's being used for reading. Now, one of the other things that has happened also is that it now looks like this might actually be even used for writing. What I mean by that is, in the past it was like, well, if you wanted to write this information, and I've got a magnet, and if it this way it's one, this way it's zero, so how do I write? Well, you put a magnetic field, a coil around it, try to get a magnetic field in there. And then if you want to read it, you use this. But now it looks like, even for writing, people could be using this kind of a structure because of this another phenomena which has been demonstrated, namely the spin torque effect, which is, works something, the basic thing looks something like this, that when you put a voltage, actually you're injecting spins into this region from here, I guess. And these spins strike this magnet and exert a force on it to actually turn it. And ordinarily, of course, if you had a relatively thick magnet, like the normal magnets we deal with, then just a few spins hitting the surface wouldn't have any effect really. Because whatever hits the surface, it's like gone within few nanometers. I mean, 1 or 2 nanometers. But after that, it's all, the magnet gets them in the right direction, the magnet likes, that's it. But if you had a thin enough magnet, that's what you call a nanomagnet, thin meaning it's not like the area is small, the cross-sectional area is still large, but it's just the thickness is maybe a few monolayers. So you're talking like 2 nanometers, 3 nanometers. Then just by hitting it with enough spins at the surface, you can turn this thing and cause it to turn over. So what has been shown is that if you put a negative voltage on this side, so you actually inject spins from here with the same, in the same direction as this, then they go to this magnet, and if it happens to be pointing in this direction, the spin torque can turn it back in this direction. On the other hand, if you put a positive voltage, then what you're doing is extracting electrons in this direction, so which is almost like injecting the opposite. And that then goes there and actually turns the magnet in the opposite direction. So this is now well demonstrated, and this spin torque is being, again, people are trying to actually use it for writing and real devices. So all that is like happening very much, and in the next few years, I think you'll see a lot more of that. So in this memory devices, the use of MTJs for both reading and writing information. Okay? Now, that's not what I'll be talking about, though, in the rest of the talk. But the main point I wanted to make here is that one of these things that has really happened in the last, I'd say, 10 years now, is this integration of two fields that 10 years ago I'd have said were totally different fields. You know, there was this field of spintronics, which is what about, well, about studying spins in semiconductors, how they move, how you manipulate them, etc. That's one kind of thing. And when you think of spins, you think of quantum physics, you think of low temperature, it's a whole different field. On the other hand, there's magnetics. Magnets, very real thing. We all have one on our refrigerator probably. You know, something, you know, very practical, room temperature, we understand that. And it's two different fields, ordinarily. You see? I mean, totally different conferences, you don't talk to each other, that's a whole different thing. Okay? Now, on the other hand, now what's happened is, it's now pretty clear that with magnets you can inject spins, with spins you can turn magnets, it's like magnets and spins, it's like one big field now. You see? And the kind of simulation tools that you sort of need for that field would be something like this. That expression, maybe I'll keep it up here. So usually you'd have it, so some kind of a transport model of the kind we are talking about in this summer school at length, you know, where you put in some voltage and you get some current. So usually given a voltage, you try to calculate currents. So that's what people who would be talking about this kind of devices would be using. Now, people who work on magnets, they have a totally different way of describing the dynamics of magnets. So usually this equation that is used widely, it's something called the LLG equation, this Landau-Lifshitz-Gilbert equation. It describes how the magnetization of a magnet responds to various external forces. And in the past, of course, external forces meant magnetic fields, because the only way you turned a magnet was by putting a magnetic field. But now, the new thing is you could turn a magnet by throwing spins at it. And so it's like you can have spin current come in and turn a magnet. So M would be like the magnetization of your magnet. And this LLG equation, if you tell it the spin current that you're throwing at it, spin current means what? We'll talk more about that. What is the rate at which you're throwing spins at it? That spin then turns this magnet, and the LLG equation describes it. And this then actually has to go back into the transport equation, because when you're describing transport, you need to know which direction the magnet is. You see, because if the magnet's pointing this way, it's one thing. You have to handle your contacts accordingly. If the magnet's pointing the other way, it's another, etc. So this magnetization information needs to go back to your transport model. And the transport model, of course, ordinarily calculates current, but then it now needs to calculate spin current as well. But that, of course, is like the same basic formalism. I think we talked a little bit about the NEGF last day, and I think this evening Gerhardt will be talking about the NEGF method and this formal method that we use. And ordinarily, of course, you calculate just the normal current, but it's just one line in the code to calculate spin current if you want to. So not that one has to change everything. It's like basic formalisms there. That's it. So you have to, but the thing is, you need the spin current and put it back in there. And this whole thing has to be done together, essentially. See? And this is the kind of thing you need to describe devices of this type that I'm talking about. You know, where you have spins and magnets and so on. Okay. Now, as I said, in this talk, I really won't be talking very much more about this. What I really want to talk more about is things that are more at a research level at this time. What I mean is, this looks like very practical. It's like things that are based on which people are building real products. It's really out already at that level, although there's much work to be done still. Okay. Now, for understanding the physics of these things, of what's going on, what spin is about, how it works, there is another type of experiment that's very interesting. There's actually been, again, people have been doing this for some 20 years now. And it goes something like this. Here, let's say we put a contact on this. And for this purpose, I think we'll assume that this is just a normal contact, not a magnet. This one is a magnet. So, one thing we could ask is that if you apply a voltage here, like I've drawn. So it means if you looked at the chemical potential, if I take this as a zero, and I'll call this, say, a one. Now, how does the chemical potential or quasi-Fermi level, that tells you the occupation of different types of states inside, how does that vary inside this material, let's say? And the picture, and ordinarily what you'd do is you'd solve something like a diffusion equation. No, so how the, which says that the current is proportional to d mu dx. And the derivative of the chemical potential. I'm using this mu for chemical potential. I think Mark probably used F for quasi Fermi levels. So, same thing. So this is like what is the potential inside, the voltage inside. And if you plotted that, you'd see something like this. At this end, you have some value. At this end, you have some value. And always, there is this interface resistance. So you expect there to be a little drop at the interface. So this is the zero. So if I plot this mu, so I'm plotting chemical potential as a function of distance. So ordinarily, you would have thought there'd be a little bit of a drop here, a little bit of a drop there, and it would go linearly in between. And this drops at the ends, that's this interface resistance, whatever you have there. Okay. And the important point, of course, is that the upspin and the downspin, the two types of spin, see two different interface resistances. So you actually have, for one of them, a lot of drop at the interface, say somewhere here, and very little for the other one. So actually you'd get, instead of just one curve like this, you'd have one thing for upspins and one thing for downspins. So what I'm drawing here is this electrochemical potential or quasi-Fermi level. And the reason this is separating here is because in getting through this interface, so I'm drawing this how it varies from here on to this point here. That's what I'm trying to plot. And when you look at the red one, the one that has a very low interface resistance, that one has a very small drop there because it's got a low interface resistance. On the other hand, the black one with a big interface resistance, that's got a big drop there. You see? And so, they separate. Now, in a material, of course, I've drawn these two separately. And depending on what length this is, what might happen is they might come together. Because what happens in any material is that there are what are called spin flip processes. Things that take one type of spin and convert it to the other. So the reds become black, and the blacks become red, and so on. And so what, and of course, those processes are always trying to restore equilibrium. And restoring equilibrium means getting them to the same chemical potential. You know, chemical potential is a lot like temperature. At equilibrium, they want to be the same. And so if there's lots of spin flip processes, these two would have joined up right here somewhere. Whereas the way I am assuming it is that this region is much shorter than a spin flip length. That's why I've drawn it kind of separate. Otherwise, they would have joined up. But the important thing is that at this end, the two are separated quite a bit. Okay. Now, the question is, what does it look like if I look somewhere down here? Well, this thing would go on like so. And this would also go on like so. But then in this region, if this is a very long region, there's all kinds of spin flip processes, which would gradually again try to bring them together. So if you looked at it, you'd probably see they would all come together to some point here, eventually. Some average value. Now, so this is a long region, and what I'm drawing here are the electrochemical potential or quasi-Fermi level for the two types of spins. So the upspin and the downspin. And what caused them to separate is simply this difference in the interface resistance. I mean, that's what's giving it the entire physics. The point I'm saying, nothing fancy about the channel here, nothing else. It's just that the two of them have different resistances. That's what's giving you all this. Okay. Now, the point is that if you go out here, and let's say we put a little probe with which we, you know, it's a weakly coupled probe. And what we try to do is we measure the potential, local potential. You know, one thing that Mark mentioned when talking about the PN junction is that in a PN junction, when you put a although there's an electric field, when you put a voltmeter, you don't measure any potential. Why? Because what a voltmeter measures is the electrochemical potential. Right? And same here. We got two different electrochemical potentials for this. So if I put a probe here, I should be able to measure this potential. And ordinarily what you'd measure would be the average. But then, if I put a magnet there, one that, you know, let's say we have a perfect magnet, which only, let's say the magnet points in this direction. So that magnet, let's say ideally, only talks to the red one. I'll make this a little more quantitative in a minute, but for the moment, let's say, well, this one just measures the red one. Then you see, it would measure that potential. It would come to equilibrium with that red type. On the other hand, if you had a magnet, which was pointing in this direction, then what would happen is it would tend to measure the black one, because the black ones would easily equilibrate with that one, whereas not so much the red one. So depending on which way the magnet points, you'd measure a different potential. See? And that difference kind of gives you an idea of how much the spin voltage is inside. That's what you call the spin potential inside. Because as long as these two black and red chemical potentials are the same, that's like what ordinarily happens in normal devices. It's this separation between the two spins that's so special. That the fact that they have two different chemical potentials. And the way you can measure this difference is put a magnet there, see what you get when it looks this way, then turn the magnet over, see what you get, and the difference is the spin potential. And this is what you call actually a non-local measurement. Why non-local? Well, you see, if you look at the current flow, that's all happening right here. That's where the current is flowing. Out here, there's no action. It's just, this thing is just hanging out there. No current's flowing there because, after all, I don't have any contacts. If current were flowing there, where would it get out of? Even this thing is just sitting there, just floating out there. You see? But the potential you measure then, it's like outside the current path. And these kinds of measurements actually are fairly old, like late 80s, I'd say, is when the first experiments were done, or mid 80s. First experiment, Johnson, Silsby, and then it has been used a lot in the 90s and definitely more recently, where people have made exactly these measurements, you see. And now one way to understand what you get here, and let me just go through a bit of algebra there, it would look something like this. You could understand this by saying, okay, I've got a mu up, that's the upspin chemical potential, and I have a mu down. And I connect it to a probe which has a different resistance for upspins and downspins. So when I put P, I mean probe. So what is the potential, chemical potential of that probe? So that's what you measure. That's your voltmeter or whatever it's measuring there, relatively. And this is the big R. That's the small r. So you could ask, well, what will be the probe potential from this? And the argument is, it will take on whatever value it takes to make the net current zero. Why? Because it's a high impedance thing sitting there, no current can flow out. So current has to be zero. So what that means is that mu up minus mu p times R plus mu down minus mu p times capital R should be equal to zero. Why? Because what I've written here, first term is that current. Second term is that current. And of course, those two must add up to zero, meaning one of them actually has a negative sign, will work so that one cancels the other, basically. So finally, the current would be kind of going in and coming out, probably. Beg your pardon?
It should be
divided. Divided meaning? Thank you. Perfect. So, just a little algebra then, what you'll find is, the mu p is mu up times something plus mu down times something. And that basically tells you that. What does that probe measure? Well, it's a weighted average of mu up and mu down. And the weighting depends on these resistances. So what I just said a little while back was, let's assume a perfect probe, one for which, let's say, this thing is infinite. You know, then again, the algebra gets very simple, because if this is infinite, then all I have is this. And what that tells me is that mu probe is just mu up. I only measure the up potential. That's kind of what I said physically, but I'm saying mathematically you could get it from algebraically from here. Or you could say, well, if I make this one infinite, then you would be measuring the mu down. That's it. Okay? But in general, you'd be getting some average of the two. And here it's convenient. With a little algebra, you can do this. So I'll define a regular electrochemical potential as the average of mu up and mu down. So this is like, usually, of course, the two are equal, so you don't worry about it. But since they're different, the average is what you call mu. And the spin potential is like the difference between the two. So if you do that, and just from here, with a little algebra, you'd get something like this. And after you play around with this, you'd get something like mu plus mu s over 2 times So what you'd get is that the probe, what does it measure? It measures this average potential mu, that's this, plus a part that depends on the spin potential times the polarization of your probe. That is this R minus R over R plus R. That means how well that probe distinguishes between the two types. So for example, if the two R's were equal, that would correspond to a totally non-magnetic probe. In that case, what you would measure is just the average, nothing more. But then, if the probe happens to look more at the ups, then you'd get a higher potential. If it looks more at the downs, you'd get that would correspond to a negative P. In that case, you'd measure a lower potential. That's it. You see? So, let's put that here. So, this is the polarization of the probe. So, in one case, it's mu plus half mu s, in the other case, it's mu minus half mu s. And that half is simply because of, you know, the way I've defined this, as this has a divided by 2, but usually the spin potential is just the difference. People don't divide it by 2, usually. So, that's why this half here. Okay, so these kinds of measurements, as I said, have been done quite regularly. Now the interesting part, this is where I want to bring in, is that when it comes to spins, you know, so far it almost looks like, well, you've got two types of electrons, ups and downs, nothing more. But then, what would happen if this magnet, instead of pointing this way, were actually, let's say, pointing at an angle? So in other words, I've got this magnet, which is injecting your electrons, and it's pointing, say, horizontal. That's our reference direction almost, this direction. And then this magnet, I place it so it's at some angle. I mean, previously I said, well, if it's parallel, you get one thing. If it's anti-parallel, you get something else. Now you say, well, what if we put it at some intermediate angle, actually? And this is where, I guess, in general, the subtle physics of spin comes in. As I said, there's a big difference between doing collinear spintronics and non-collinear spintronics. That is, as long as all your magnets are in one particular direction, in a parallel or anti-parallel, you really don't need any more difficult concepts beyond what we just talked about. It's almost like whatever you do for normal devices, write one diffusion equation for ups, one for downs, keep track of them separately. Add them up, you'll get the regular thing. Take differences, you'll get the spin part, essentially. That's it. Okay. But then the subtle physics of spin all comes in when you do non-collinear things. And that's one example, is this one. Now the answer, though, without getting into any subtleties, the answer I think you'll find reasonable. So let me just write the answer first. It looks something like this. Mu P is equal to mu plus So previously I had this one. That's when we were just thinking of collinear things, where P was either plus one or minus one. Now, of course, P is a vector, because that measuring thing could be pointing either way. So it's now a vector. And the spin potential, that's what is inside here, that's also a vector in the sense it depends on the direction of this magnet. So this magnet tells us the direction of the spin potential inside, because it injects more of this type than the other type, and as a result, the spin potential you get inside is in this direction, whereas you're measuring in a different direction. And the answer, which is not obvious, but hopefully looks reasonable, is that it's this dot product. And that's exactly what people see, you see? Although, I don't think people have exactly done this experiment on solids. One thing I should say, that these principles of spins, by the way, where it's not like we are just learning them in the last 20 years. It's been around with us for quite some time. Back in the 30s, people had done all this, had worked all this out. And that was on the basis of experiments done in vacuum with electrons. And to some extent, what we are now doing is, we have technology has progressed enough that you can do those same kinds of experiments in semiconductors and solids. So the principles themselves are fairly old. It's not like we're discovering. It's just we're applying it in a context where we never thought we'd need this kind of thing. See? That's the electrons and solids, really. And now the way the experiments people have done, it's something like this. That is, to do this experiment, the way I described it, what you'd have to do is keep one magnet fixed and then turn the other magnet. But the way people usually do the experiment is more like this. This magnet is fixed, same direction. But you do something in the channel itself. You see, so far I said all the physics came from the contacts. Everything I've talked about. The channel was just an inert thing. You know, so a spin concern doesn't care which spin we are talking about, the channel. Everything came from contacts. But the experiments that people have done in the last, again, 10 years, is, one example is, you put a magnetic field, say, in this direction. So now what happens is, as the electrons get from channel to this point, as they're going through this region, they actually rotate around the magnetic field. Because this is, of course, not evident. I should back up a little bit, and this is something we'll talk more about as we go along, is that basically each electron is like a magnet. So this is the thing that long back the Stern-Gerlach experiment showed back in 1921, I believe, that if you put electrons through an inhomogeneous magnetic field, then they get deflected just the way magnets are expected to. So magnets in an inhomogeneous magnetic field tend to get deflected. And if the magnets in one direction deflect one way, the other way, and in the other direction deflect the other way, and electrons did the same. And individual electrons, from the amount of deflection, one could deduce exactly what the magnetic moment of an electron is. And that magnetic moment, that's what's called the Bohr magneton. That's QH bar over 2m. And the way it is deduced is by seeing in an inhomogeneous magnetic field how much it deflects. And this, if you put in the numbers, it comes to about 10 to the power minus 23 amp square meter. So, roughly speaking, each electron is like a little current loop of 1 milliamp going round in enclosing an area of, say, 1 angstrom by 1 angstrom. Because if you take that current and multiply it by that area, you'd get that number. Of course, this is not a unique combination. You could work out anything else for that matter. So not to take it too seriously. But the point I'm trying to make is, basic observation is, every electron is kind of like a magnet on its own. Okay? But this needs to be qualified more, and I'll try to say a few little more about it. Now, so every electron is like a magnet. So in that case, why is it that only a few materials are magnetic? Well, because ordinarily they are all paired up. So if you take silicon, if there's a magnet in this direction, there's one in the opposite direction. So all, overall doesn't amount to much. On the other hand, there's the special magnetic materials where there are internal forces which actually cause all the electrons to line up, so that you have lots of them all pointing in the same direction, and that's what makes a magnet. Right? And you could take that number and multiply it by the number of these little magnets per unit volume, and then what you'd get would be a macroscopic quantity like the magnetization. So if you divide this by the volume, the atomic volume, that's meter cubed, you'd actually get a number that would be amperes per meter, which will tell you the actual macroscopic magnetization of a magnet. Now, so every electron is basically like a magnet, and the point I was trying to make is what's known is that if you had a magnetic field in some direction and you had a magnet, then its magnetization wants to precess around that direction. And the same here, each of these little electrons here is like a little magnet, and so if you put a magnetic field like this, it wants to precess around it. And so instead of turning this receiving magnet, what you could do is change the magnetic field. So that way what would happen is, you see, the experiment that's easier to understand was what I described earlier, and that is inject electrons in this direction and then turn this one. That's what I said. But let's say inject in this direction, keep that fixed, but turn the electrons themselves. So put a magnetic field so that by the time it gets here, it's pointing this way. Or increase the magnetic field, so by the time it gets here, it's pointing in some other direction. So that's almost like turning the magnet. You're turning the electron itself. And that's the way people have done these experiments, where what's called the Hanley effect, for example. That is, you put a magnetic field in this direction, and what you find is that the voltage you get there changes as you change the magnetic field, equivalent to sort of turning the magnet, as I was saying. And the way you would understand it would be, again, based on this. That is, the straightforward way would have been, keep this fixed, turn the magnet that's receiving it. But equivalent thing is, keep the receiving thing fixed, just turn what's coming in. That's the experiment, right? And another experiment that has been done, again, in the last few years, is in some of these spin orbit materials, high spin orbit materials. And that is that usually, of course, when we talk of magnetic fields, this is something that you externally apply. But what's been known again since the 30s is that due to relativistic effects, actually, electrons in solids feel an effective magnetic field when they are in an electric field. That is, there is an effective magnetic field, even though you are not applying anything. There's an effective magnetic field that is proportional to the electric field cross their momentum. Proportional to that. I'm not writing the proportionality. So in a strong electric field, there is an effective magnetic field. And this is particularly true of materials with high spin orbit coupling. And in general, what happens, what's known as, if the elements involved are kind of higher up in the periodic table, they tend to have more spin orbit coupling. So if you took like carbon, it would be relatively small, silicon more, gallium arsenide more, etc. And in all these materials, people have measured these coefficients, know exactly what should be. And what has been shown now is that if you change the electric field in this direction, of course, the electron is going in this way, so E cross P, that's like an effective magnetic field in this direction. And that, again, turns the spins. See? And that's also now a couple of experiments that show that, actually. Okay? Now, this high spin orbit thing, that is an example of something where you're actually using a property of the channel. You see, so far everything was about the contacts. And this kind of brings us to this thing about topological insulators, again, a topic that's of great interest nowadays. And these also involve materials with high spin orbit coupling. See? And the basic thing, let me just mention a bit. Runs something like this, that if you take a conductor, and put it in a high magnetic field in the perpendicular direction, then what's known is in a magnetic field, electrons want to go around in circles. And this has nothing to do with spin. You know, just electrons would classically do that because of this Lorentz force. The same thing that gives you Hall effect, basically. So it just wants to go around in circles like this. Okay. Now, what happens around the edges, though, is something interesting. And that is, you see, if you're here, then you just go around in circles. It's not getting you anywhere. But if you're near an edge, then what would happen is you turn around, hit a wall, come back, turn around, hit a wall again, and so on. And on the whole, you'd be progressing in one direction. On the other hand, if you're at this wall, you'd go the other way. And these are what are called edge states, actually. But this is just a simple classical picture of an edge state. Quantum mechanically, the way one would talk about this is they would say, well, if we consider a sample like this, and let's say we look at the density of states, usually in a uniform material, what you expect is density of states should be uniform everywhere, normally. See, when you take a piece of silicon, we talk about the density of states per unit volume. It's all uniform. But in these materials, at high magnetic field, if we were to plot the density of states, so let's say we plot it something like this, that this axis, let's say Z, and in this direction, I'll plot energy. What I drew here, of course, was real space. What I mean is this is Z, this was, say, X. But right now, for what I'm drawing, I'll think of this direction as energy. This is just the width of the conductor. And what we are going to show here is the density of states. Because the reason I don't need this axis is the density of states doesn't change along the length. But the point is it changes along the width. So I'm So let's use this direction for energy. And the idea is you could do what's called this grayscale plot. That is, let's look at the density of states. If it's high, I'll look, make it look black. So if you do that, you'll see things like this. So in here, you'll see discrete levels where the energy kind of density of states piles up. And these are what are called Landau levels. And this is what people understand classically as saying, well, the electron goes around in circles, but all energies are not acceptable because only those are allowed for which the circumference is a multiple of a wavelength. That's the simple classical picture of why you only get specific energies. Those are the ones at which the radius is just right. But the point is, if you come to the edges, you'd see something like this. So if your chemical potential happens to be, say, somewhere here, then you'd say, well, in the middle, there's no density of states, because all the density of states is either here or here. So if you looked here, you'd say it's a no density of states. So you'd say, okay, it's kind of like a, what you call insulator inside. On the other hand, when you get to the edges, then it looks like that you have states. So here's a material, uniform material in a uniform magnetic field. The middle is an insulator, but the edges are conducting. And this is something that has now been known for quite some time. What I mean is, I guess it wasn't known when I was a graduate student, but that's a long time ago. The thing is, this has been, I think it was discovered, let's say, around 1980 or so. Okay?